How does change happen? Whether it's in public opinion, legislation, our behaviour, our communities, or just one person's life? That's our question. This is Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. Fossil Free is the fastest growing divestment campaign of its kind in history, starting in the US and spreading around the world. It's been massively successful here in the UK, with 50% of universities and 13 local authorities already pledging to divest. At the same time, activists are seeking to withdraw the social licence to operate from oil companies. They get this in part through their financial support for theatres, galleries and museums. By making this sponsorship unacceptable, groups like Culture Unstained are challenging the comfy power structures that both sets of institutions have enjoyed. Billions have been shifted to cleaner investments globally, and oil companies have started to panic about the damage caused to their reputations. To discuss the story of fossil fuel divestment so far, we're joined by Ellen Gibson, UK Divestment Network Coordinator with 350.org. Sakina Sheikh, a local councillor and divestment campaigner with Platform. And Chris Garrard, a composer and co-director of Culture Unstained. We first asked our panellists to tell us about how their campaign has emerged and how they got involved. Here's Ellen Gibson.
I think it's worth saying that the idea for the divestment campaign and where it came from is directly drawn from campaign history and particularly the anti-apartheid movement. The 1980s, which really successfully used divestment as a tool to stigmatise and withdraw the social and political licence of the South African government, the apartheid government. Similarly, I guess, the divestment campaign is not about trying to bankrupt the fossil fuel industry. That would be quite difficult because they make a lot of money digging up oil, but really about trying to pull their social license, damage their reputation, and stigmatise the industry, because they are one of the most significant blocks to effective climate action at kind of a global level. So while it's not a kind of financial campaign, money is kind of the conduit for making more of a political and symbolic statement.
Chris Garrard.
I think what Ellen was saying about the origins of the divestment campaign being in the anti-apartheid movement is that you also saw campaigning around sponsorship, and it was the case that there was campaigning around sponsorship and corporate private giving to arts and cultural institutions around that issue as well, so that there is that kind of common thread. We think the first kind of protest or creative action against oil companies or fossil fuel companies sponsoring cultural institutions in the UK, we think, was around 15 years ago. But it really kind of came to prominence more around 10 years ago with a group called Liberate Tate, who there's this famous story of how they were invited to do a workshop at Tate around protest in art. It was quietly suggested to them that they didn't pick on any of the sponsors of Tate. Of course, when you do that, the thing that an artist is logically going to do is pick the thing that they've been told that they can't do. And so followed this extensive campaign of creative actions against sponsorship. Each of these groups are using different creative and artistic tactics to express their opposition, to express their dissent, and that being both an enjoyable and expressive way of doing activism, but also a way of making a strategic intervention in these institutions that we seek to change.
Sakina Sheikh.
You know, the successes of the divestment movement that we'll unpick this afternoon really have come from the grassroots, and I know that Ellen in particular has done a lot of work with groups, and Chris in terms of groups working on the pushing cultural institutions, and I think that's really been the foundation of the bedrock of the divest movement. And actually what the divest movement has really done is it's democratised, I think, a lot of our engagement with local government or with sort of bigger institutions, and I think it's been a campaign that's really wedged open a door and said that actually people in the community, wherever we live, are as entitled to make decisions as those who are elected to do so. And I think that kind of transformation of political culture and that shift of political culture is really, really exciting and will have long-lasting impacts way beyond the point at which we have divested every institution, which I have no doubt that we will do. I think maybe I started working on this maybe 3 years ago. I kind of was... encouraged by a colleague who suggested that actually got so many fantastic groups on the ground building this incredible movement and pushing their local councillors or other institutions to do this work. And actually what we could also do is supplement that with an inside track and help build that political courage on the inside. And I concentrated specifically on local government, less with universities or other institutions. But it was about maybe local councillors who were keen to take climate action and didn't realise they could do that through the pensions fund, or they were on the pensions fund and they were getting bombarded by campaigners, which is a great thing, because like I said, that's created a culture of democratization of decision making. And it was about building political courage for them, being able to, you know, build a financial case for divestment that meant actually we also have to meet some of these institutions where they're at and push that way. So I think, yeah, building that kind of inside track, building the financial case for divestment, and building off the back of really powerful work that local groups have been doing. And it's actually one of the few campaigns where I've really understood the need for racial justice and class solidarity to be embedded at the centre of this conversation. It's not about tackling the climate crisis, it's about moving towards climate justice so that equality is embedded at the centre of it. I think climate change is as much of a racial issue and a class issue as it is about the actual climate.
So, what communities and groups need to be part of the process of change?
I would sort of really echo sort of everything that Sakina sort of highlighted there. And I think that is something that has become much more central to a lot of the campaigns and the campaign groups and organisations working on the issue of oil sponsorship are doing. And also the way that people think about their activism and their protest and the purpose of it. How is it centred on climate justice as opposed to climate change? And so one particular group, BP or Not BP, which is a group that I've been involved in for many years, but in a sort of voluntary capacity, began as a sort of small group of people objecting to the Royal Shakespeare Company being sponsored by BP. As that group has evolved and grown, we've asked different questions of what it is that we do and whose voices are centred in it. It's a group that is largely white and middle class. And I think this really came home when we were campaigning around the British Museum and they put on an exhibition called Indigenous Australia, Enduring Civilization. And it was sponsored by BP. And it's a huge understatement to say that the extractive industries don't have a good reputation within Australia, but particularly with Indigenous communities in Australia for years of colonial exploitation of their land. And there's too much to unpack in the time we have there. But there was a real question about what was our role as activists and campaigners speaking on that issue. So it shifted how we used these creative interventions, and they actually instead became platforms for the voices of impacted communities or the communities whose objects were on display in these exhibitions as well. Mm-hmm. And for those campaigns, for those groups, that's where this kind of intersectionality comes into focus. We could not simply just be campaigning on climate change and that being our core focus, that we had to bring in, well, it was just the right thing to do, to be using our interventions and our protests as a platform for those voices of people being directly impacted by BP on the front line, who were seeing those impacts on their day-to-day lives. And then it became a kind of different question of what role do we play? And so the first intervention we actually did, we went in dressed as robbers in black and white t-shirts with swag bags, because we were more closely aligned as white middle class activists with the colonial history of the British Museum. And so that is how we tried to locate ourselves in that performance. We recently held a tour of stolen objects within the British Museum and highlighting how the BP sponsorship is a reflection of that colonial history of the British Museum as much as these questions around its collection. And it's a complex thing to do, they're challenging questions, and importantly, we've made mistakes along the way, and we've had to learn from them. But I think it is really by understanding that we really can't be single issue, that we have to bring these things together, and that's actually strategically where our strength lies, is by working together in that way.
Ellen?
Yeah, I think that all of this kind of speaks to something which I see as kind of the sneaky side goal of the divestment movement. It's a campaign that is about pulling money, pulling political power from the fossil fuel industry, but it's also fundamentally a tool to build the power of the climate movement and to build a political movement aligned around climate justice. I think part of the reason that divestment and these sponsorship campaigns have been so successful, have been picked up so widely, is because there's this kind of sense that anyone anywhere can find a way to make it relate to their lives, whether it is campaigning around your local council in the area you live, or your university campus, your church or your faith group. You know, there is this completely decentralized network that people can link into in whatever way is relevant to them. And that, for me, is the way that we're going to build a powerful climate movement. It's not going to be a boardroom of NGO folks sitting in a room, but really about like dissolving that power out to a wider network of people. And divestment has really enabled that to happen. There's groups, you know, all around the UK, all over the world, campaigning for divestment, and they really have a lot of ownership over the strategy for those campaigns. They call the shots, really, on how that works. They decide how they're going to run that campaign, who the stakeholders are, who the targets are, but we're united under this common vision and common identity. Movement building and building this diverse, powerful movement is a goal in itself, in my mind, because the sorts of change that we need to bring about to address climate change are deep-rooted, are systemic, are about addressing the root causes of economic, environmental, racial injustice. And that has to be underpinned by a powerful social movement, because you can't create those changes by just, I guess, fiddling around the edges in a way. And you can't rely on just a political party to put it in their manifesto and make it happen by themselves. It needs to be underpinned by that powerful movement. So I think the divestment movement has really unlocked the potential of the climate movement more broadly for people to get involved in their own communities, which for me is really important. I think like an example of this, and where you can now see it bearing fruit for the wider movement, is really for the first few years of the divestment movement, the focus was really strongly on universities and on university campuses. That was where it came from, the idea. That was where Power first started getting built in the UK. One of our allied organisations, People and Planet, support, you know, I think 70 or 80 student groups in campuses around the UK to campaign for divestment. I think nearly 50% of those universities have now divested. But also what that's done is it's empowered a generation of climate activists who are now growing into the movement more widely, who have learned incredible skills, have been empowered, and like learned how to make change happen, and are going out and doing it themselves in all sorts of other ways as well. The places where we have seen really strong and powerful wins for the divestment movement, for the divestment campaign, hasn't just come when an institution, be it a council or a church or a university or whoever, has just put out their policy and said they're moving their money. Those things actually are happening all the time these days, and happening so much that often we don't even notice them. It comes from when there is this powerful local campaign that is linked in with their community, that is making their demand really clearly, bringing in local stakeholders, and actually having that fight in a public way. And really, like, having that fight publicly partly achieves the goal of the campaign in itself. You know, I think the BP or not BP campaign around the British Museum has kind of demonstrated that. While British Museum is still sponsored by BP, having this really public fight with the British Museum about whether BP sponsorship is an acceptable thing for them to have has partly accomplished that goal of stigmatising the fossil fuel industry and of withdrawing their social licence, because in the fight comes that stigmatisation. So, like, as much as possible, when I'm working with local groups around the country, I'm really trying to emphasise to them that we can kind of win our bigger goals of this campaign, even if you can't get your institution to move, if you run your campaign in a way which is about building public support, leveraging political power, and doing that in a fun and creative and engaging way.
This is Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. We're discussing the movement to deny fossil fuel companies both financial investment and social approval. Taking part in this discussion are 350.org coordinator Ellen Gibson, local councillor and divestment campaigner Sakina Sheikh, composer and cultural activist Chris Garrard. We asked the panel to reflect on the value of pursuing change through cultural institutions and creative action.
It's worth saying that because of these campaigns, BP is no longer sponsoring the Tate. BP is no longer sponsoring the Edinburgh International Festival. Shell no longer sponsors the Van Gogh Museum in the Netherlands. Shell no longer is partnered with the National Gallery in London, etc. So those campaign wins feel good and they're great. When these campaigns began, there was still this sense that climate change was a purely scientific issue. So people such as us, as myself, as a composer, or whatever our background, that we need to leave this to scientists, to policymakers, and that it's an issue over there. And as we've realised and as these movements have grown, it's highlighted that it is this kind of more political issue, a question of democracy, essentially. And by bringing that conversation about climate change into the cultural space, it has made it more accessible. It's highlighted how the solution or the ways that we're going to address climate change need to be rooted in the ways that we express ourselves, the ways that we form communities and so on. And that can sound quite idealistic, but I think it's actually very specific and tangible. And there's like a whole history of creative activism, but I think what these groups that I've been involved in have done, one, in terms of trying to break down and I've written the word de-alienate, but I'm not even sure that's a word, but you know what I mean? It's like, so if you go into the British Museum, you have to go through the columns and you go into this big space and there's glass cases and you're like, whoa, this is intimidating. To go into that space and say, I'm a taxpayer, this building, this intimidating space is accountable to me. This is my space, this is a national museum, that there is a political activity going on there alongside campaigning to get rid of the BP sponsorship. We're trying to reclaim public space, break back into public space, essentially, and that's a really important part of the artistic dimension. And then the creativity is also a tool for empowering people in a lot of cases as well. So if you give someone a banner and say, can you stand here, and that policeman might come and stand in front of you and tell you to move, that's horrifically intimidating for a lot of people. Whereas our invitation was, come to the British Museum, maybe bring some lunch, have a look at a few things, then we'll maybe teach you a song, then maybe we'll go on a procession. And just, like, what are those things that make political agency or make activism as really connect with your own sense of self-expression, connect with your own personal identity, and that we've got all these other possible modes of expressing our resistance and our dissent and our protest that are available to us. And what's interesting is that I think that, I'm not saying it's all down to just these groups, but I think that approach to how we try and express our dissent, how we inhabit and situate ourselves within our activism, I think that's really spread and we see it through all different kinds of campaign now.
Sakina.
But I think art and creativity are a really crucial part of it, because I think for us, art is where we begin to shift the paradigms of what is or isn't acceptable. And artists, I think, in many ways are mirrors to ways that we need to progress or within our societies. And I really, creative spaces are where we begin to actually cultivate that positivity of the world we do want to live in, the world we do want to imagine. I think particularly right now when we are at a point where we rapidly need to decarbonize everything and rapidly need to shift towards a climate transition, creativity has to be the muscle that we exercise to do that. Fazana Khan is someone who used to work at Platform, and she used to talk about the fact that a lot of the industries and a lot of political institutional spaces have actually, you know, she talks about it in the context of when the colonizers were colonizing. You can almost place it in philosophy. I think it's Descartes who says, I think, therefore I am. And what it does is it says that you think only with your head, and it severs the connection of the head and the heart. And actually, in a lot of ancestral traditions, thinking with your head and your heart is a non-Eurocentric, really powerful way of telling stories and knowledge production. And I think art does that. I think it encourages you to think with your head and your heart. And I think that's the only way we have been able to cultivate opposition to the financial industry and the fossil fuel industry, which I think stand in opposition to creativity and stand in opposition to thinking with your head and your heart, which is when I think we make the most powerful decisions. One campaign we used to try and support and uplift the voices of was Ken Sarawiwa, who was a Nigerian dissenter. And I think when we talk, you know, I think we were broadly framing the need for divestment as pushing back against the many abuses of the fossil fuel industry, but human rights abuses are certainly part of that. And Shell sort of, I think, in the 1980s, rocked up in the Niger Delta, which is in the south of Nigeria, and started drilling for oil. And what it meant was that they poisoned the lands and they poisoned the waters. And the Ogoni people who were indigenous to that land, who were dependent on that land for their livelihood. I mean, we know that indigenous people look after 80% of the biodiversity of the world. And suddenly their waters were being poisoned, their land was being poisoned. I think when Shell was doing that, you robbed the people of their land. And if their livelihood are linked to their land, well, you can imagine what happened to those people. And I think Ken Sarawiwa, along with nine other dissenters, they were called the Ogoni Nine, pushed back against this abusive behaviour from Shell. And unfortunately, they were hung for this dissent. And it was found that Shell was complicit in pushing for their hanging. And to this day, it hasn't been cleared up. And to this day, I don't think Ken Sarawiwa's family has seen justice, nor have the Ogoni people. And in part of telling the story, Platform commissioned a Nigerian artist based here in the UK. They had this kind of bus, and it was another way of telling the story of Ken Sarawiwa and the Ogoni people. And I think they parked outside City Hall and said, you know, London is where the fossil fuel industry has its home. And what are we doing as Londoners to push back against that? What are we doing as the UK, as a place that actually offers political cover to the fossil fuel industry? When we talked earlier about, you know, embedding racial justice and which communities should we be in solidarity with, well, that's how we're in solidarity with the Global South. We use our privilege as those in the Global North who do provide political cover to these fossil fuel industries to say we don't accept human rights abuses anywhere in the world, and we certainly don't tolerate the deprioritisation of black and brown lives.
It's like a media and political class that have decided what they think an activist is, particularly an environmental activist, which is a hippie sitting around in a drum circle in a field somewhere, basically. They're white and they're privileged, but they've rejected that privilege for a life of, you know, whatever, living in a tent or something. But we know, firstly, that is not the case, that the roots of many of our movements, they're not coming from hippies sitting around in drum circles. They are coming from working class communities, from communities of colour. And I think, like, creativity of tactics allows us to break out of the box that the kind of media and political class has created for us as activists and challenge this narrative of who we are as people. You know, and that narrative is very carefully designed to kind of other and differentiate activists from normal people. But when we are using art and playfulness and being silly and being creative and like bringing those things to the centre, it makes it very hard for, I guess, our opponents to set the frame for us and to decide who we are, because we're like consciously claiming that space back. And I think you see that even in like Evening Standard piece that gets published whenever there's an action that happens at the British Museum. And they just don't really know how to frame a headline around, there's a giant 40-foot kraken made out of umbrellas being controlled by 100 people parading around the floor of the British Museum. What do we even say about that? You know, it's allowing us to set the frame and set the tone. And so, like, strategically and tactically, I think it's completely crucial that we're, like, embedding innovation of tactics into our movement so that we can't just be othered as a group of shouty people who take themselves far too seriously on the sidelines of society, but actually as like at the core of political change and at the core of all the most significant political changes that have happened in the last, you know, century or more.
Finally, what are the opportunities and challenges when it comes to influencing formal power or public attitudes? Ellen Gibson.
I guess the whole kind of premise of the divestment movement is to harness institutional power and use it for creating change, allowing students at their university to use essentially the brand of their university and its power in the public sphere to make a statement about the fossil fuel industry and say that it has no place in our future. And generally, I think that's been a really important and significant tactic, and one which is used by a whole kind of plethora of different social movements. I think a drawback to this form of campaigning or strategy is that it necessarily sort of, I think it limits the number of people that can feel ownership or engagement with the campaign in some ways. I think that while in theory everyone lives in a local council and can campaign around their local council, if you're from a community that doesn't feel like they benefit from the local council, doesn't feel like they have any relationship with traditional political structures, then the campaign doesn't make the same sort of, I guess, inherent sense as it does for someone that is super engaged in politics or has access to the benefits of that, has access to that power. And I think that that has had an impact on who the core of the divestment movement really has been, which in my experience has been people that perhaps are already politically activated, and it's giving them like a really powerful campaign to go and run with, but maybe hasn't been as good at speaking to people that have yet to be activated by a political issue, because it speaks to that institutional power so directly. If you think about, you know, universities, very elite institutions, campaigning around universities is really only open to society's elites. And so while we're using that quite effectively and kind of, I guess, harnessing that privilege to try and make a statement about the fossil fuel industry, it also has impacts on who feels that they can engage in that campaign. And that's been an ongoing challenge, I think, for the divestment movement to navigate. There's a difference between wanting to stigmatise the fossil fuel industry and shut down and dismantle their power. What we don't want is, for example, maybe what's happened to the tobacco industry, which is they're massively stigmatised. Everyone hates the tobacco industry, but they're still raking in billions in profits and operating, you know, just as they were before, largely. We can't allow that to be the outcome of the divestment movement. We need to be aiming for wider political goals. So one thing that we've been doing in the UK in the last couple of years, we launched a campaign called Divest Parliament, which is about getting the MPs to sign up to campaign for their own pension fund to divest. The MPs pension pot invests hundreds of millions in fossil fuel companies and the tobacco industry and all sorts of other dodgy people. But it's really taking that message that's like, keep fossil fuels in the ground, dismantle the industry, into the kind of central political halls of power. And I think that will enable us to navigate this question around transferring the power of the movement into like actually taking political power back much more easily.
Here's Chris Garrard.
So the industry has this term, it's social license to operate. So without this kind of tacit consent of wider society, going and drilling for more oil in the Gulf of Mexico isn't possible. Or allying yourself with a regime which flaunts human rights left, right and centre. That kind of thing cannot be gotten away with. So that's why we're targeting the social licence piece. We often talk in our campaign about the social licence piece, but there's an element at which it goes beyond that to being almost willfully complicit in the endorsement of those business plans. So to me, I feel like it's often much more severe than we give ourselves the space to acknowledge. And I think it's important we recognise the kind of depth of that deception. And the reason I mentioned that is I think that then comes to the question of institutional power. So there's a question about money and the fact that the British Museum get a bit of money from BP, but it's probably around 0.5% of their budget. If they say the government keeps cutting our money, well, next to a small local museum in the north, that's a very different problem for the British Museum, who could maybe find another sponsor. So why is it that that relationship still exists? Might it actually have more to do with the perpetuating neo-colonial attitudes, the white privileged men who are on the board, who is the chair, who's the director, the extent of the influence of the white privileged men at the top of the fossil fuel companies? And you start realising that the particular institutions that are sponsored by these oil companies are almost the logical partners. And they're also logical because they are arm's length government bodies. Another example, an exhibition about Russia. You realise that BP was also sponsoring the museum the British Museum was partnering with in Russia. So they were effectively sponsoring cultural diplomacy between two countries, or they were wanting to go and frack in Russia. So it goes further and it goes deeper. So yes, we need the public protest and so on, but we also need to pursue the accountability. We went to the National Portrait Gallery with a report of all the relevant human rights cases related to BP and said your ethics policy says you reserve the right not to form a partnership with a company that has any link to human rights violations, yet you still renewed that sponsorship deal. So I think diversity of tactics is really key to challenging institutional power. If we just mobilise one group of stakeholders or one interest group, we'll only get so far, but we have to have that diversity of tactics. And just very quickly on the public engagement question, is one thing that we had for our campaign is people often saying, well, I don't go to Tate, or the British Museum is an institution that I don't feel represents me. And I mentioned earlier how there's been this growing conversation about repatriation. Where did the British Museum's collection come from? And as that debate has come more to the forefront, actually that's opened up a much richer space for talking about why the conversation about fossil fuel sponsorship of these particular institutions is relevant to a much wider kind of group of people, a much more diverse group of people. So it goes back to the point I made earlier, that public engagement will only advance if we continue to listen and build those connections with other groups and other communities.
Sakina Sheikh.
I think that when you begin to map the divest commitments across the UK, but particularly in London, a lot of the times you will hear local government pension schemes say this is a direct result, our commitment for this is a direct result of local campaigners on the ground. And I think building or reminding ourselves and those institutions of what accountability means, that is what accountability means, that actually people in the community set the agenda and it is the duty of councillors and local government to implement it. I think the mystification of the financial industry, you know, as you've heard from Ellen and Chris, they are predominantly older, white, middle-class men who sit in suits and they use a language that isn't necessary. They're talking about things we already have words for, but they have created another vocabulary to mystify ideas and lock away an ability to access conversations around those ideas. And I think that part of that has been, you know, A, shifting who we have around the table. Pension committees have predominantly been older, white, middle-class men. And I think having younger folk, having people of colour, having working-class folk, having people from the LGBTQI community, the trans community, changing who's in that room is how we will change the decisions that are made in those spaces, because we'll have different minds thinking differently, exercising that creative muscle. So again, a challenge that has actually, I think, opened up space for an opportunity. You know, one thing that I talk about when we talk about climate justice is this idea of environmental racism, that actually air pollution affects disproportionately working class and black and brown folks the most. But unfortunately, sort of in London and in the UK, climate change has become depoliticized. The mainstream political narrative from our political parties have depoliticized issues around climate change. And I think an opportunity going forward is, you know, rather than saying air pollution, saying environmental racism, like actually repoliticizing the issues around climate change, because it is around power and that power and the abuse of power in the fossil fuel industry. So I think there's a lot to be done, but a lot has been done. I think we are, you know, we've been making really powerful headway, but I look forward to continuing that work with many of you.
You've been listening to Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate and review and share it with friends or colleagues. You can find out more about the Social Change Project at www.smk.org.uk.